Hello, everybody. So I've been put in charge of this episode of our Challenging Questions series. So we're talking about science and faith. Specifically, this question, is faith reasonable? You could say, is faith logical? Is faith based on reason? So my first reaction to this, so it's not really an issue. It's something that I sort of stopped worrying about quite a while ago. For a couple of reasons. First of all, my brother, as many of you know, is a microbiologist. He's currently doing his PhD at King's College London, researching proteins and drugs and something that I don't quite understand. But that basically means that science and religion, him being science, me being religion, has been dinner table conversation for quite a long time. Thank you. I've been icing and elevating for almost 48 hours now. And me personally, I've always loved science. I wasn't great at it. I'm not very mathematical, so I didn't do it for A-level or anything, but I did it for GCSE and loved it. I love things that explode, and I particularly love astronomy, and when they find new galaxies, and they're just so pretty. Like, supernovas are so pretty, which is why I particularly love this photo. This is the... I can't remember what it's called. It's a space observatory on Hawaii, because that's near the equator and therefore the kind of nearest to space that we have in Earth. This is particularly on Mauna Kea, which is one of the volcanic mountains in Hawaii. And I love this photo because you can see the science and you can also see the vast expanse of space, which is what they're studying. Another reason I kind of thought this wasn't really an issue is because for a very, very long time, it kind of wasn't. Within theology, you had a tradition of two things, the book of scripture and the book of nature. And these were the two sources from which you could learn about God. The book of scripture, we all know well, one of these. But the book of nature was all about looking into the world around us. It was about finding out what God had made. Like you might find out about an artist by looking at the art that they've put out there, or find out about a novelist by reading the style of their work, you look at the world that God has created and go, yeah, that tells me something about who God is. So these two sources of information kind of played off each other, and a lot of theology for hundreds, if not thousands of years, was done on the basis of what God had said in the book of scripture and also what God had made through nature. I don't know if any of you have heard of the monk Gregor Johann Mendel, who's become famous for his pea plants. He was a monk and he grew pea plants. Oh, I pressed the button. What's mine? And he actually filled in one of the gaps in Darwin's Origin of Species. When it was originally put out, there was a lot of contention, partly because no one knew about DNA yet. So this whole like, things kind of vary, and then they live, and some of them die, and they're like, how do things just vary? So this whole area of genetic mutation was only filled in by this monk, Mendel, who looked at his pea plants and realized the way that he bred them meant they were picking up different defects from each other. There have also been, as I'm sure you're aware, many, many scientist Christians, Christian scientists, just a few to name, Isaac Newton, Johannes Kepler, of astronomy fame, Blaise Pascal, Mary Anning, Michael Faraday, and Katherine Johnson. Katherine Johnson you might know from Hidden Figures, if any of you saw that movie, helped take a spacecraft to space, because that's where spacecraft go. And this same kind of scientific adoration of nature we find mirrored in the Bible. So picked out particularly Psalm 104. I mean, we've heard a lot of stuff like this already this morning. I didn't pick verses. So let's see. He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. You covered it with the watery depths as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. But at your rebuke, the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. There's some really great praise in this Psalm 104. I encourage you to go and read it. All about the different parts of creation and reflecting the glory of God in creation. It's very much that book of nature approach to knowing about God. But my initial blasé approach to this topic was recently challenged quite seriously. Some of you may know that when I'm not here, being a pastoral assistant, I am working for the National Trust. I'm a food and beverage team member, which means barista, and table cleaner and occasional sandwich maker, working at a couple of National Trust properties nearby. We had a staff night out quite recently. We went to TGI Fridays in Reading with a whole load of us, loads of people I hadn't met from different properties, some I had. And I made the fatal mistake of saying, hey, yeah, I do theology and I want to become a minister. And there are a couple of people who went, right, in a staff night out where we're going to be doomed to awkward conversation, how about we jump on this girl for what she's just said? And I was challenged with a lot of emotional baggage, shall we say, from a couple of these girls. And one line that one of them said, and it came in a whole string of questions that I just couldn't have the time to answer, was this one, if I can point in the right direction. Why am I going to hell because I believe in quantum physics? And that, it's kind of funny, right? Because of just how wrong it is. But that also absolutely broke my heart because she said it with such conviction. She said it so sure that her belief in quantum physics was sending her to hell, that someone has clearly told that to her at some point. She's not just made that up. She's had a background where someone has said, look, science, Jesus cannot go together. But there's only one reason that you end up in hell, and it has nothing to do with quantum physics. In fact, everyone's going to hell except for Jesus. That's the only thing that makes you go to hell, is not having Jesus, which is one of the first big problems with this statement. Secondly, you don't believe in quantum physics. It's not like quantum physics is another religion that is set up and it's like, oh, I can't have both. I can't have Christianity and quantum physics. It just doesn't work like that. But the way that she said this, and the fact that I couldn't counter it at the time because they were shooting so many questions at me one after another, it really reminded me that this science and faith conflict is a serious problem. It's something that is not just a difficult question to answer. It's not just a fun Sunday morning mind puzzle. It's something that is keeping people from approaching Jesus. This girl, when she said, why am I going to hell because I believe in quantum physics, really believed that her scientific background meant she couldn't approach Jesus. She didn't even want to consider it because she's like, well, I'm already out, aren't I? Because I've done this, it means I can't even come close to Jesus. And that absolutely broke my heart. So, there's lots of different ways of coming at this question, and I'm sure some of you will have questions in mind I'm not going to answer, but I'm going to do the best that I can. And the way that I've zeroed in on this particular question is through Richard Dawkins. We all love Richard Dawkins, don't we? I sometimes wonder if people would like to make an effigy of him and burn him instead of Guy Fawkes. But this particular quote is taken from The God Delusion, that brilliant book that I read before part of my application to uni. And this, I think, quite sums up the ideological conflict that kind of boiling that down to this one statement. So it is an essential part of the scientific enterprise to admit ignorance, even to exult in ignorance as a challenge to future conquests. One of the truly bad effects of religion is that it teaches us that it is a virtue to be satisfied with not understanding. First things first, if you're all satisfied with not understanding, can I go home? Why do we do sermons every morning, every Sunday morning? Why do we bother to have Bible studies and things if we're all satisfied with not understanding? But this is, let's call it the perceived crux of the conflict, definitely from the scientific perspective, that conflict between ignorance and knowledge, between exploration and satisfaction, between thinking you've got all the answers and thinking that there are still billions of answers that we need to find. And there are verses that certainly immediately, for me, come to mind with this charge. For example, 2 Corinthians 5:7, for we walk by faith, not by sight. and Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. That Hebrews 1 is paraphrased by Thomas Aquinas. Faith has to do with things that are not seen, and hope with things that are not in hand. We'll come back to these particular scriptures later. But certainly, the first impression we get is that faith is about ignorance. It's therefore not reasonable. It's not based on reason. It glorifies the not knowing. It asks you to be satisfied with not understanding, which is where Dawkins and people like him get this particular idea. It's kind of putting the blindness into blind faith. On the contrary, and we'll come, I'm going to go into a lot more detail with this, but the first thing that came to mind was John 4, which is where Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well. And they have a conversation about living water, they have a conversation about worship, but in the end of the conversation, before the disciples rejoin him, he says this, if I just find where I am. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshippers must worship in the Spirit and in truth. The woman said, I know that the Messiah, called the Christ, is coming. When he comes, he'll explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. So just to highlight the end of that, the woman says to him, I know the Messiah is coming, and then he'll explain all these things that we don't understand. And Jesus says, I'm here. That's me. I am here to explain to you those things that you do not understand. I'm here to bring you understanding. That doesn't sound much like being satisfied with not understanding. This is a Jesus, I remind you, who said, I am the truth, at the same time as the way and the life, of course. But there's a lot in Jesus' nature of understanding and clarity, revelation, we might call it. In fact, this is something that John picks up elsewhere. At the beginning of the gospel, he calls Jesus the Logos. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That word, Word, is Logos, which is one of the most difficult, notoriously difficult words to translate from Greek, because it does mean Word. It can mean Word, rather, but it could also have a massive array of other meanings. It can mean message, so when you string many words together, it can mean reason. So the kind of thinking behind what you say and reasoning, your kind of logical process, logical order. In fact, that word logos is the root of the word logic. Also logistics. And all of those words that end in ology, so biology, geology, psychology. Also trilogy, but that's a slightly different etymology. So in all of this, it's to do with study. It's to do with reason and order and thought, and is often used for the underlying rational order of the universe in Greek philosophical tradition. So when John says Jesus is the Logos, he's kind of saying Jesus is the rational order behind the universe. The very nature of Christ is reason, is exploration and understanding, all of those great scientific principles. John Polkinghorne, who's a Christian scientific writer, writes this. Above all, science requires commitment to the basic act of faith that there is a deep rational order in the world awaiting discovery. And that's something that Polkinghorne specifically puts down to Christian tradition. It's the Western culture that first birthed scientific practice as it now exists for us. And that is based on the idea that the world has an underlying rational order, which is an idea the West gets from Christianity. When you have God, a rational creator who's made everything, you can presume that that single creator has imprinted a single rational order underneath everything that he's made, which is something that you can sum up with Jesus as the Logos, Jesus as that rational order. So on one level, there is a very Christian basis to exactly what science is. So what's the further problem? That is what brings me specifically to faith. My question, after all, is faith reasonable? That was supposed to be my picture for logic. There we go. I've forgotten what's on my PowerPoint. And this is my nice illustration for faith. Isn't it cute? So, 2 Corinthians 5:7, they walk by faith and not by sight, and Hebrews 11:1. Faith, it seems, is all about ignorance. It's about not seeing, not knowing, not hearing. Faith is a virtue. We know this. Paul makes that very clear. And if faith is about not knowing and not seeing, it's about ignorance, and therefore Dawkins is right. We're making a virtue of not understanding. Now, exactly what faith is a sermon series in itself. So I'm going to do my best. Please forgive me if I don't quite manage it. But in order to distill it down, I'm going to lean quite heavily on Hebrews. Partly because I did a whole paper in my third year on Hebrews. Partly because chapter 11 of Hebrews is a brilliant way to look at exactly what faith is. The first verse of chapter 11, there we go. Now faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance of what we do not see. That's what I've already said, is often expressed as the definition of faith, and it very much emphasizes that not knowing. But the first verse is clarified by the second and all of the material that follows afterwards. It's all about the people who are then listed. All of these people have been pulled out of the Old Testament as examples of faith. So here's a few of them. What we're basically going to do is a very scientific enterprise of testing the hypothesis that faith in the first verse means simply belief in God's existence, or that it means that kind of not knowing. So, who have we got? I've entirely forgotten who I was going to pull out. Here we go. Noah, in the top left there. Noah's faith is described as responding to the warning of God. God says rain is going to come. Noah's like, great, okay, let's start building an ark. Even though he can't see any rain actually coming. Abraham, similarly, was given a command by God. God said, go, and he left. And he later particularly demonstrates his faith through the near sacrifice of Isaac. Again, being told to do something and following it. In that particular case, his faith is summarized in believing that God will still give him the son that's been promised, even though he's asking him to kill the son that's already been given. Moses, illustrated through a little still from the Prince of Egypt, gives up his royal heritage. He's a prince in Egypt, and he has everything that you could ever wish for. But in being called to lead Israel, he is asked to give that all up. So these people, and some of the others that are up there, their faith is summarized in their obedience to God's commands, in their willingness to step out and do what has been asked for them, despite not seeing the fulfillment that will come. But not all of the examples of faith in Hebrews 11 are anything to do with God at all. I have the photo in the bottom left of Moses being put into his little basket by his mother. Moses' parents are an example that's given in Hebrews 11 of faith, but their faith is because of their love of their child. They are sort of faithful to him, and they want to save him from the massacre of the children. There's nothing actually in there that says they were obeying God in any way. Secondly, Rahab, who saves the Jericho spies by sheltering them when the city guard come looking. Again, she doesn't even believe in God at this particular juncture, but her faith is summarized in her response to the spies' promise. They say to her, if you do this, we won't kill you. We'll save you and your family when we take this city. So she kind of has faith in them and in that promise that they've given her. But she and Moses' parents are listed alongside Noah, Abraham, Enoch, David, and all the others who are big examples of exactly what faith is, as Hebrews, the author of Hebrews, is describing this definition, is clarifying what he's already said. So the word for faith in Greek is pistis. which I'm just going to use for clarity to kind of try and divide what Hebrews is actually saying from what we think faith means. So when Hebrews uses the word pistis, there is no uniquely Christian meaning to that word. This is something that I got taught quite forcefully. I had a tutor who's very used to rooting out Christian presuppositions. When the Hebrews writer said pistis, they didn't come with like a leaflet being like, so when I say this, this is what it means. It doesn't have any particular unique meaning. It was a word used in other contexts by other people, and by other people who weren't Christians. Right? You following me? So, one can have pistis in many ways. You have pistis in a parent, or in a friend, or you can have pistis in a general, for example. Pistis is very relational. Faith is relational. It's more like trust than blind following. it's in the ways that you believe that someone will do something they've promised to do. The ways that you believe someone will be there for you when you need them. In verse 11 of chapter 11, we read, "And by faith, even Sarah, who was past childbearing age, was enabled to bear children because she considered him faithful who had made the promise." So Sarah has faith, so she has the child by faith, because she considers God faithful. Okay? It's a response thing. She has faith because God is faithful. We have faith because God is faithful. It's a sort of responsive thing. We know what God is like, and so we have faith. There's an underlying reason to faith. We see this happen throughout the Bible when God instructs the Israelites to do stuff. It's often predicated by, I am the God who brought you out of Egypt. Therefore, listen to me. Sort of based on that past relationship and the history that they have. That's why the Passover is so important in Hebrew and later Jewish tradition. It's because it's about that first relationship. In case I haven't quite convinced you, here we go. Chapter 11 culminates actually at the beginning of chapter 12. Remember, chapter divisions are something we put in later. So at the beginning of chapter 12, we read about Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. That means Jesus had faith. Not only did he had faith better and in a leading way, better than we ever have done. Which doesn't seem to make sense if faith just means believing that God exists. Jesus' faith is epitomized in the cross, in believing that God will raise him from the dead, in following the Father's purposes for his life, in having that faith. So in the same way that Jesus had faith because of God's faithfulness, so we do the same. Therefore, faith is reasonable in a way. It's logical because it is based on experience that we've already had. But it's not scientifically logical, because you go forward not being quite sure that what's going to happen in the future is exactly what's happened in the past. It's not 100% sure. If you think of like a leap of faith, we have that phrase. But when you do the leap of faith on a high wires course, they're not just like, go jump off the thing. And you're like, sure. Because that would be blind faith. You do a leap of faith because you've already sat in the harness. You know it's going to save you. You know the guys who have set up the high wires course have had other people jump off here before who haven't died, you hope. You know they've got you this far. And so when you jump, you have faith in all those things before. And you've still got that doubt. You're still jumping off a platform into the unknown. But you've got that relational experience behind you that enables you to jump forward. Okay. I came across this cartoon on Facebook the other day. It's by Nathan Pyle, who does all these kind of panel cartoons of aliens come to Earth. And this particular one, the little child alien, has attempted a science project. And I'll read it if anyone can't quite. So, I have attempted science, says the little alien. And the teacher says, please explain. I formed the idea, and I discovered I was wrong. Oh, there are numerous diagrams. I was wrong in numerous ways. I produced a detailed tribute to my wrongness. And the conclusion, that is science. This is quite an apt and humorous summary of kind of what science is. It's like what Dawkins was saying. Science is all about mistakes. It's about asking questions and being wrong and then getting right and then being wrong again. But we're often, honestly, petrified of being wrong. And therefore, we get petrified of asking questions. And that makes sense. It makes sense, of course, because this is Jesus, this is God. And this stuff really, really matters, which means it really, really matters if we're not right about it. But you've got to remember that there's only a real core of belief that really, really matters. That's why people wrote creeds. That's why people wrote summaries of what it was that really, really mattered. There's stuff outside of that that you can ask questions about, I guarantee it. If you just look at the first few centuries of Christian history, if my clicker works, here's an illustration. This is the Council of Nicaea, I think. The first few centuries of Christian history are total chaos, theologically. It's total chaos. There's people like insulting each other. There's people who we consider bastions of the church who honestly were heretical. There's bishops being ousted. There's plots and everything. Because everyone's still trying to work out what's going on here. People are like, yeah, so this is what I think Jesus is. And then someone goes, no, that's really not what Jesus is at all. And here's why. Heresy is actually the driving force behind eventual orthodoxy. The mistakes are essential for working out the truth later. It's only when someone goes, yeah, I think Jesus is like mostly God, but not quite God, that the other bishops turn around and go, that's a problem. We need to not say that ever again. And that's how the Council of Nicaea really happened. So to do theology is essentially to do this. It's to ask these questions, to be wrong, to bounce off each other and eventually work out what the answers actually are. And I've got to remind you that we don't live in the kingdom yet. That's something that happens later. Paul puts it quite well. I think I've got this bookmarked. Yeah. Although you probably know this verse already, but I will remind you of it anyway. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 9 onwards. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. So, when we make mistakes in this life, it's not the end of the world. Because at some point, at the end of the world, we'll know. That's something that comes later when we can see God face to face. And I guarantee that I believe a great number of things that are wrong in one way or another. You've got to keep asking questions and be open to that. And that's a faith thing as well, having the faith to ask those questions. Because Jesus is good. And he's true and he is forgiving and he will not abandon you because you seriously consider whether we evolved from monkeys. So, back to Dawkins' original charge. One of the truly bad effects of religion is that it teaches us that it is a virtue to be satisfied with not understanding. And there is one sense in which this is true that I think we need to touch on briefly. I can't remember what I've got next. Okay. Oh yeah. Pretty pictures. And that is not actually faith, but what we call mystery. You've probably heard of mystery. But Gregory of Nazianzus, who you might remember if you came to Esther's sermon on feminism, he's an early church father. He wrote lots of really cool stuff, and particularly he wrote 5 theological orations on the nature of God. And it's a debate about the unbegottenness, the begottenness of Christ and the proceeding of the Holy Spirit that we do not need to worry about now, except to give context to this particular quote. which is in one of his arguments near the end about the Holy Spirit. What then is proceeding? You, he challenges his interlocutor, you explain the ingeneracy of the Father, and I will give you a biological account of the Son's begetting and the Spirit's proceeding. And let us go mad, the pair of us, for prying into God's secrets. Let us go mad. And so he challenges, try it, you will fail. In other words, our little human minds aren't able to comprehend what God really is, so back off. It's that sort of, it's not even a being satisfied with not understanding, it's a kind of command to stop trying. And he's not the only one to say this kind of thing, he's just an emphatic example. We've probably all heard the phrase, God moves in mysterious ways. Or the song that begins, who can know the mind of our creator? Again, it sounds like Dawkins was right. We're being satisfied with not understanding. This particular tradition is apophaticism. It's quite mystical. It's about talking about God using negatives. Words like incorporeal, flawless, invisible, or not of this world. It's rather than trying to pinpoint exactly what God is, it's saying what God is not. And it's very, very not scientific, because it basically puts God out of reach of investigation. It says we can't really ask questions about him. But of course God's out of reach. In that way, at least, God is not an object within his own creation. There's a really common illustration that goes with people saying this, and that is that Shakespeare is not a character in Hamlet. Hamlet himself cannot wander around and be like, ah, now I shall examine who Shakespeare is. You can get a sense of it from his creation, that book of nature thing. But you can't find Shakespeare himself. Other examples, Margaret Atwood is not a character in The Handmaid's Tale. George Lucas is not wandering around in Star Wars. You can't find the creator inside the creation. God makes a really emphatic point of this in Job 38, where he kind of challenges Job, were you there when I laid the foundations of the heavens? Oh, yeah, sure, tell me then, how deep are the oceans? Surely you know, and it's quite a sarcastic challenge for Job and his friends having overreached themselves in trying to explain who God is. And particularly, this reminds me of Exodus 3 at the burning bush, when God introduces himself to Moses as, I am who I am. It's not really telling you anything, it's just, hey, I am. Deal with it. God is not of this world. And that means we can't ask questions about his nature in the same way that we might about the way things blow up or the way the stars look through telescopes. But the important thing to remember about mystery is that we don't really relish it. We don't indulge in it. We're not like, yeah, I love not knowing anything. It's great. You have to be satisfied with it. In fact, I challenge you, like Gregory puts it, try to fathom God. Try to dig into what his nature is. Try to understand everything. Give all of your mental intellectual might into it, and you will fail. But it's worth trying. I've sat in tutorials trying, just being like, it's not working very well, is it? There's a reason it's not working well, and that's because it's God. But when you fail, what you end up with is a giving in to who God is. A realization that God is outside of us, that God is not something that is human, that we can understand. And what happens in that capitulation is worship. In Gregory's oration, when he basically gives in and says, look, I'd love to explain this to you, but I can't. What he ends up doing is saying how great God is. Let's turn ourselves over to worship him because we can't understand him. Because we recognize that in trying to understand him and failing, he is so far beyond us. But that mystery applies to God's nature, applies to God because God is outside. There is still a lot about Christianity and a lot about our faith that is inside creation. In fact, that's one of the unique facets of Christianity, is that God has made himself inside creation through Jesus. That's why the incarnation is so amazing, that the unknowable God became knowable. And the Bible as well. It's right here. It's within creation. I can weigh its mass and stuff, but also the words within it can be examined as historical record, as written by someone at some time. And therefore, you can ask questions about it. I think it's a mistake to grant the words within this book the same unknowability as God's very nature. Ask questions about it. We don't believe it dropped out of heaven like it is, and we don't believe, like Islam does, that it was dictated verbatim from God himself. I encourage you to ask questions about that. So, in conclusion, you might be glad to hear, is faith reasonable? I can't believe I've got, there we go, that's the beginning. Is faith reasonable? Yes and no. It's always yes and no, otherwise you wouldn't still be asking the question. Faith is reasonable in as far as it's about relationship, and relationship is based on experience. It's based on what's come before. It's based on things that you already know. It has a basis, a logic behind it. But it's not limited to that past experience. It's about the going forward, the leap of faith, the jumping off that comes after the walking harnessed in. And nobody believes in Jesus just because they've been told to. No one has faith just like that. There's always a reason behind it. There's always something that has brought you to faith. In the same way that the Israelites always look back to the Exodus, they look back to the history of God with his people. I encourage everyone here to look back to your own history with God and to look back to other people's history with God. He is the same God for all of us. That's why we have a Bible full of stories that tell us about God's history with his people. That's why we share testimonies with each other when we get baptized. That's why we get to know each other. And that's why it's great to share what's going on in our lives and what God is doing with us, because it helps each of us understand who God is and have that basis with which we can go forward. So what about the very question of faith and science? If we have faith to embrace ignorance and some uncertainty, to embrace the fact that in this world, in this life, we don't know everything, really, that's quite scientific. It's embracing the uncertainty of life, knowing that certainty is something that is reserved for later on. Yes, God's nature is outside of the world and sort of untouchable and ineffable. But so much of God is inside the world. So much is open to our questions and our understanding. And Jesus, as the Logos, as that rational order behind the world, is an encouragement to ask those questions. He is the truth. He is here, as he said to the Samaritan woman at the well, to answer all of those questions. And so we make our peace with maybe not understanding, but that doesn't mean we're satisfied with it in the way that Dawkins accuses us. We look forward to when we get our answers face to face in the end. And until then, let this be my main exhortation to all of you to keep asking questions, and we'll keep trying to find answers. Amen.